Anyhow, so you're listening to the Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM, and we are joined now, I believe, by Stephen Gowans. Are you there, sir?
I am. Hello, Phil.
Hello, and I hope you have a happy New Year coming up. And you wrote a really great article, and I'm sorry to be slow to get in touch with you about it, because it's the early part of December. You wrote an essay at gowans.wordpress.com, and your launch point was that there had been this really important encounter between Paris Match, I guess one of the most important magazines in France, and the president of Syria. And, to get us started on a good note, the president of Syria, Mr. Assad, seemed to be on his toes. You point out that they tried to use the word regime on him. So you want to talk about what you took from that article and why that was your starting point?
Yeah, he's been interviewed a number of times by various media outlets throughout the world, generally not those in North America, but from some Western European countries and China and elsewhere. And they're always very interesting interviews because he is quite acute, and he does make very cogent points. And in the Paris Match interview, he was presented with a number of contentious claims, which he managed to refute, I think, quite convincingly. Mm. And one of which was, he was told that many people say the solution to what's happening in Syria lies in your departure. And do you believe that your departure is the solution? Which is kind of a silly question. I mean, you could ask the same question. Well, I suppose it would be a solution. If he stepped down, it would be a solution. However, also if
from the Pentagon's point of view.
Sure, and it would be a solution if the Islamists were to withdraw as well. Mm-hmm. But anyway, his reply was, well, would it be a solution? What happened and he referred specifically to France, what happened as a result of French policy when they attacked Gaddafi? I mean, the objective was Gaddafi's departure, and what happened? I mean, was departure the solution? As he pointed out, I mean, Libya has not become a democracy, and Libya is in complete and utter chaos. And the implication was that if you asked him to step down, the same thing would happen. Mm-hmm. However, he made the point that he's not going to step down, and he's not going to step down not because he wants to remain president, because he said, we will never accept that Syria becomes a Western puppet state. Mm-hmm. Cynical people could say, yeah, right. I mean, his real concern is that he's going to lose power. However, you have to look at the context and recognize that Syria, or the Syrian government, the Syrian state, is one that is based on self-determination for Syria. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was ideologically driven. It was anti-colonialist, anti-imperialist. It sought to achieve self-determination for Syrians. Syria had been a French colony and an Ottoman possession, and the Syrians wanted their independence. Mm-hmm. So you could look at this cynically, or you could look at it in the context of the history of Syria. And I think it's reasonable to suggest that indeed President Assad genuinely opposes the idea of Syria becoming a Western puppet state, which almost inevitably would happen if he stepped down.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking to Steve Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, and you were very precise. You inciting U.S. Individuals, powerful ones, who discussed what's wrong about his economy. And interesting, they use language which all of these, you know, in the West, we have all kinds of people write anti-war journals, socialist journals, and supposedly anti-colonial journals who don't give him the time of day, the government of Syria, but the U.S. government chose the word socialist. That was among the things they don't like about him.
Yeah, you The U.S. State Department, for example, you can read some of their documents. They're easy to find. They're online. They complain about the, quote, ideological reasons that prevent him from, quote, liberalizing the economy. So that is making it profitable for foreign investors. If you read the U.S. Library of Congress country study of Syria, and that's easily available online, you'll see that that refers disapprovingly to, quote, the socialist structure of the Syrian government and economy. I mean, it is in large measure a publicly owned economy. There are many state-owned enterprises. So there's not a lot of room for investment by Western Western corporations and investors. And so the United States government, which tends to represent the interests of corporations and banks and investors, isn't particularly keen on Mr. Assad's economy.
And it's striking that, as you point out, that to them that was a deal breaker. You just could not talk to someone who had an economy with the ideological configuration it had. It was like no point in talking further. He has to go. It's like the bottom line for them.
Yes. And I mean, that's incredibly arrogant, too. I mean, who is the United States or the Gulf powers, they're the allies of the United States, to say who shall rule in Syria and to decide who has to go and who can stay? But they do decide who can go and who can stay. Curiously, there are other people they haven't asked to go that you might think they would. They're so interested in promoting democracy and human rights. They haven't asked anyone in Saudi Arabia to go. They haven't asked anyone in Bahrain to go. They haven't asked the leader of Egypt to go. Although, I mean, he's certainly effectively a dictator who's been rounding up people and putting them in jail for supporting the previous president, who the current president had deposed in a military coup. So,
There's none of the fervor, etc. It is striking, and of course you've always discussed this matter, is how pliant the media is and getting to just go with a story that, well, he's not democratic, as though there's anybody in that neighborhood that's known for democracy. Incidentally, they ignore the fact there was an election there in June, which I think everybody agreed, well, I shouldn't say everybody, but there seemed to be no dispute that it had been an actual election, pretty good by the standards of the world, probably as good as Florida.
Yes, there had been an election, and Assad had won. Well, one of the other things that they mention is that the Assad government had made arrangements with the internal opposition to change the constitution. So previously, the Ba'athist Party was the lead party in Syria.
Basically one party, yes.
Yeah, but the constitution was changed so that it was no longer the lead party and that any Syrian could run for president. And that the opposition, the internal opposition, could participate in the electoral process, and that went ahead. And I don't think anyone was really surprised that Assad won the election. The only people opposed to him were mainly an opposition which is foreign-funded and which largely now originates from outside of Syria.
I don't know if I stressed it there, but you pointed out that he caught them using the word regime. And he said, well, let's be clear here. I mean, that was... I know you put great stress on getting the right word in the right place. And he said that we're the state of Syria. We're not a regime. In your essay, went through this, how often they will turn language around.
That's the typical practice in the Western media. I mean, there's certain words that you use to describe some governments and other words that you use to describe others. So offending states, or the states that Western powers are hostile to, become regimes, and they have secret police.
Mm-hmm.
the security agencies we have, members of the state are regime personnel, or my favorite, the leader's cronies, government members or ministers. And if the state is large enough, it has satellites or an empire versus mm-hmm. the United States' strategic interests and its allies. So in the interview, Assad would have none of that. When his government was referred to a regime, he retorted, well, let's agree on terms first. In Syria, we have a state. We don't have a regime.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Gowans, again, I want everybody to know who we're talking to. Wouldn't this? I like the fact that you worked from what he said, just as you also work from what governments actually say. I mean, that really should be sort of the form, don't you think? That if we would probably make less errors if we started always from what did they actually say, as opposed to what is a columnist in the New York Times think the significance of what he thought he heard. We would all be better. Wouldn't it be a great thing if people would simply, if we had, for example, a paper that prints all the news, that's, what is it, fit to print, would give us his words whenever he said anything. I mean, if the American people were to read, for example, well, Putin gave a press conference recently. Well, why don't they print that so that we could all understand what he's saying? I know that they then call him a dictator and a maniac and an egotist and a guy who doesn't wear a shirt, but they don't tell us what he actually said. And we're satisfied with that. I mean, that's like having a diet with no nutrition in it, right?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting point. I was watching a film by, I can't recall the name of it, but a film by the journalist and filmmaker John Pilger. I think it was about the media's treatment of the Anglo-U.S. war in Iraq. And he was talking to a news executive, and he was asking, how is it that your journalists accepted the lies about weapons of mass destruction, and you did not criticize or look at these claims critically? How is it that that happened? And his reply was, well, the job of the mass media is not to actually critically analyze what people in power say. It's simply to report what they say. And it's up to everyone else to decide whether it's true or not.
That's a little somewhat disingenuous, isn't it?
But, I mean, you can see that. There's a lot of simply, leftist critics of the media have long maintained that the media is simply stenographers for people in power. They simply mm-hmm. report what people say, what high state officials say. Mm-hmm. And even when those things are completely improbable, they don't challenge them. But mm-hmm. as you point out, the Western mass media do not report what Putin says, or what the Syrian president says, or what the president of any other country under attack says.
Mm-hmm. Now you give the, he started with Libya, and you also discussed that. What it's worth revisiting, because frankly I don't think we learned enough about what the Libyan point of view was. You discussed that the decision of to remove Gaddafi was based on his turning out to be a tough negotiator when it came to the value of his oil. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, and he could see this in the Wall Street Journal and in other newspapers, months after he'd actually been ousted, and it was too late to do anything about it, and suddenly the truth starts coming out. And there were articles in the Wall Street Journal talking about how it was that the U.S. State Department and the U.S. oil industry was very upset about the tough bargains that Gaddafi was driving.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. State Department was complaining about that Gaddafi was practicing resource nationalism.
Oh, I like that term. I'm really glad to. We should underline that. Resource nationalism. We probably should warn Harper. You could get into trouble with this stuff.
Well. So Gaddafi was, he was simply insisting that foreign investment in Libya worked to the benefit of Libyans. which was an attitude that threatened to cut into the profit margins of Western investors. And here was this admission in the Wall Street Journal that the oil companies were saying, good, I mean, we need to get rid of them. We need to get rid of them because, you know, the foreign investment climate isn't suitable to us making as much money as we'd like to make.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially for telling Western oil companies that they, and the State Department actually, there was a leaked, a WikiLeaks memo from the State Department who pointed out that someone in the State Department said, look what he's saying. He's saying, you know what, Western oil companies have for years made billions of dollars off of Libyan oil, and now it's time for us to start making some money as well. And they found that an offensive comment and something that said that here's a guy who had to go.
He's not with the program.
I mean, essentially, he was telling Western oil companies that they could go to hell if they thought they were going to get rich on Libyan oil while leaving Libya with nothing.
Yes.
And I think a lot of that accounts for why we see certain countries come in the crosshairs of Western foreign policy. Essentially, what they're saying is you can go to hell if you think that you're going to exploit our resources, and we're getting nothing in return.
Yes, and I'm glad. I noticed that you've developed a euphemism here based on your quotation from Milosevic. In your article, you quote Toronto lawyer Christopher Black about a conversation he had and how he got into trouble. And he said that they could go to hell, I think. It was used another expression, but roughly the same.
Yeah, I mean,
and by the way, aren't more and more people feeling, you notice how we're drifting into this, the language is becoming more coarse and blunt. I guess maybe that's what it is, that people are tired of kidding around. I mean, Mr. Milosevic, they drew him into a peace process, but then they decided that they were then going to destroy him. I'll let you elaborate on that. What your thoughts are about the Milosevic story?
Well, yeah, in the reference to Black, I was watching him talk about asking Milosevic, why is it that you think that you've been dragged in front of this criminal tribunal in The Hague? And he said, Milosevic said, well, there are two reasons. One, because I'm a communist. And secondly, and he said Milosevic didn't
mince words.
Or harshly, but essentially said because he told the Americans to go to hell.
Yeah.
So, which is to say that he refused to turn Yugoslavia into a Western puppet state. Exactly what Assad's saying he's not going to do. I'm not going to turn Syria into a Western puppet state, which I think has connections too with what Gaddafi was saying. I'm not going to turn Libya into a kind of a Western puppet state like the Gulf oil monarchies where you can extract as much wealth out of our resources as you want.
Yes. By the way, introduces an interesting subjective factor among those who have turned themselves into poodles or whatever it is, puppets. They get very offended at a puppet who resists or somebody who wants to make into a puppet. It becomes sort of like, well, we sold out. You've got to sell out. We're going to help destroy you, all those servants.
Yeah. We're going to help destroy.
They have a sort of a psychological problem. You too have to become a slave. We're going to catch you,
right? And we're going to destroy you, invoking pretexts which actually describe our own behavior as well.
Yes,
the double standard is incredible. When you think that Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and other Gulf monarchies are talking about creating democracy in Syria.
Yes,
and I think there's a lesson to be learned about from this, and or a message that's being sent, which is create a good foreign investment climate, become a market for the U.S. arms industry, turn over your resources to the West, cooperate with the U.S. military, and you can kill as many of your people as you like.
Yes.
Resist democracy as long as you want and merrily trample on human rights, but just don't insist that your economy works to the benefit of your own people, because yes, once you do, you're in trouble.
Yes.
That's the message.
Yes. Reminding us all of the time somebody said that Somoza was an SOB, and Franklin Roosevelt said, yes, he's our SOB.
Yes.
It certainly pays, would help us all to be reminded. By the way, now this is Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, and I really urge you to read this article. It's quite well done and covers a lot of territory. One of the subjects you talk about is this the new kid in town, the ISIS, the most popular new bandit. And you link Turkey and Saudi Arabia, and you are absolutely categorical about it. Turkey and Saudi Arabia are the sort of the mom and papa of ISIS. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I don't think there's much controversy about that. I mean, you can find all kinds of confirmation for the claim that ISIS is getting money, maybe not from the governments of Saudi Arabia, but certainly from people within Saudi Arabia. And it's certainly being supported by Turkey. I mean, there's no question about that. And it's interesting that Turkey continues to be an ally of the United States and Canada, despite the fact that it's quite clearly supporting ISIS. Mm-hmm. And the ideology of ISIS and also the al-Nusra Front, which are the principal rebel forces in Syria, originate in Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And Western powers have used Islamic extremists for decades as allies of convenience to undermine secular nationalist movements and to attack communist and socialist and Arab nationalist states. So what's happening in Syria is nothing new. I mean, this is simply a continuation of the kind of U.S. Arab or reactionary Arab state for, or foreign policy.
Mm-hmm. And you also use that occasion to discuss the moderates, for example, the New Democratic Party and the Liberal Party, and I guess the Green Party, and certainly Mr. Harper, love the moderates, and they want to give them weapons, and they want to help them. Can you tell us who the moderates are? I think you say there are no moderates.
There are no moderates.
There's the word I'm looking for.
It's not me that said that. I mean, if you look at the veteran or lead Middle East correspondent like Patrick Coburn, for example, I mean, he'll point out there are no moderate Islamists. That's a complete myth. And if you look at the groups that are said to be moderate and you look closely at them, you see they're not moderate, they're Islamists. But moderate is used, the phrase moderate is used in a very special way. What it means is amenable to direction by Washington. It doesn't mean that, and there's absolutely no evidence that they're democratic or that they yearn for democracy or for human rights, none at all. I mean, most of the journalists who are covering them will tell you that those who are deemed moderate Islamists or the moderate opposition are Islamists who want to establish a government based on the Quran, not based on democracy and liberal values.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you look at the United States acknowledges that its policy in Syria is not to let these people come to power, but to use them to force a political settlement in which Assad steps down and is replaced by someone who's acceptable to the United States.
Yeah. And by the way, in a rational republic and a democracy, to say such things should be the basis of impeachment. And by the way, there are a few voices, I mean, I guess former Congressman Kucinich, who remain rational and say, you have to be impeached for your behavior, for the, putting violent, totally nihilistic killers on the ground, savaging the people of Syria in the name of removing somebody. That's a heavy crime.
Yes. and the evidence of how severe the crime is. I find it really interesting that ISIS was not a problem until ISIS threatened the government of Iraq. I mean, here it was beheading people throughout Syria and
yes,
killing, and at the time no one was really complaining much about them, simply, you know, describing them as the opposition. The opposition. It was only because they became this unique evil once they threatened Baghdad.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and some of the Kurdish friends of the Americans who have a kind of a piece of territory there. I remember we interviewed on this show this writer on military affairs, Scott Taylor. He said that he traveled in that region. You don't see any Iraqi flags. You only see the flags of this Kurdish area. Mm-hmm. And he says they behave like an independent government.
Yeah.
There's something very odd and special is going on there. I wonder, did you notice that there are members of the Iraqi legislature who are making an issue now of this question we asked you the last time we spoke, is why don't they have an air force? The Americans went in there in 2003. They've been there all this time training and arming and equipping and advising, and they never managed to teach anybody to fly a plane.
Well, it seems that they have to do a lot of training and advising. And they did a lot of training and advising, and the Iraqi army collapsed.
Yeah.
And Patrick Coburn was asking today, how is it that ISIS seems to be able to fight effectively after 2 weeks of training? And also seems to know how to operate the tanks that they acquired from the Iraqi army that were given to them by the United States, whereas the Iraqis didn't seem to know how to operate the same tank.
Those are excellent questions. Well, I like the theme of your piece very much, Stephen. I guess we can agree that Mr. Milosevic, Mr. Assad, are quite right to say, the government of Venezuela, the government of Cuba, that to hell with you, right? If there's someone tries to give them orders.
Yes, especially if we're concerned about democracy in any kind of meaningful sense. I mean, the lives of people in Venezuela and Cuba and Syria shouldn't be determined from outside by the decision of U.S. presidents about who should be ruling in a particular country.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I should say, I want to make sure I ask this. On the kind of business about moderates, a moderate would be someone who would be willing to negotiate, wouldn't he? I mean, if a man says, I'm never going to talk to anybody, that would be the mark of an extremist. But the moderates that America says it's supporting, their starting point is we won't talk to Assad.
Yes, you're right, and that's a good point. They won't talk to Assad because they don't think they have to, because the United States is going to help them bring Assad down, so there's no point in negotiating.
Yeah. So when Assad says anything, their eyes turn to the guy holding the leash.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a great article, and it's Stephen Gowans, gowans.wordpress.com, and I really appreciate talking to you, Stephen, and have a good New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye. And that's Stephen Gowans. It is a great site. And he writes clearly and at length. And as close as I can determine to that when he feels exercised, he allows the occasional vulgarism to slip in, and this article contains at least three or four, so it tells you, even though he's a totally rational guy, he wants you to know how he feels. This is the Taylor Report, CIET 89.5 FM, and I will close with we got a few minutes here with moments. I already told you about the American sniper. Ha ha ha. And we will follow the trial of Mr. Roth. And see how Texas justice deals with an ex-Marine who shot an ex-Navy SEAL. By the way, I hate to bring up old problems, but when I was with the Corps, we didn't like Navy people, even though we were attached to the Navy, and Army guys don't like either one of us, and all of us have contempt for the Air Force. So if all of you are drunk and you get in a pickup truck and there's a bunch of loaded weapons and you're from different branches of the service, you got a very poor chance of getting to your destination, happily. But on a historical thing, of course, it's the anniversary of the Treaty of Ghent. I will remind you again, the War of 1812 is over. It ended with the signatures Belgium, what is now Belgium, at Ghent. There were major American representatives there, Mr. Clay, Mr. Adams, Mr. Gallatin. There were no particular important people from Britain. I didn't think it was that important a deal. I agree with them. There was the agreement was that we will go back to where we were, we'll stand down as per previous, although the British lost the Great Lakes because they had owned the Great Lakes before the war started. They didn't own them anymore when it was over. And about War of 1812, people should remember that from the British point of view, it had to do with Napoleon. They were more concerned with their confrontation with Napoleon, of course. As for the Canadians, so-called, if you were referring to them in 1812, you would have meant people who speak French. They weren't terribly interested either. There was no one from Canada represented. And, of course, the Native Americans and Native Canadians, the people on Canadian soil, all lost the whole show. The Battle of New Orleans happened in the following, about 2 weeks later. The British lost their commanders and they went home. Very important story. One ought to look into it. Anyway, you've been listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 9.5 FM, and we'll see you next week.